Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.5 in the Mattsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site. You can find all of our episodes over on iTunes, and you can check us out on the web at dogworksradio.com. And on social media under the same name, just search for Dog Works Radio. And calling in from Southern California is our co-host, Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. Starting to look like it's really becoming spring pretty much all over the place. But very excited to talk to our guest today.
I am too. It is spring up here in Alaska. Most of the snow has melted here in the Willow area and the Mattsu. It looks like we're going to have an early spring and hopefully a rainy spring to calm down those fires from last year. You know, it's only been about 10, 11 months now since the Sockeye fire, and things sure have changed around here in Willow, but I think we're going to be all right. So, Alex, let's introduce our guest today, calling in from England. Her name is Kim Franklin. She finished her first Iditarod just about a month ago. She came in 68th place, finishing in 12 days, 23 hours, and 39 minutes. Kim, how's it going?
It's going very well, thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Can you give us a quick bio? Tell us who you are and what you're all about, please.
My name's Kim. I've always lived in the UK. I started racing Alaskan Malamutes for fun here in sort of the late 80s, early 90s. And basically that's where my interest in Alaska and the Iditarod started.
So, Kim, the way we typically do this, and for folks that are listening, is we usually go back and forth. I'll ask a question and then Alex, and then just sort of go back and forth and possibly have some follow-up there. So my first question to you, Kim, is, living in the UK, I've never been to that part of the world, so I'm unfamiliar really with, other than what I've seen on the internet and TV, you know, how winters are up there. So do you guys have any snow in order to mush on, or are you doing all carts and rigs and that sort of thing when you're doing your mushing up in that part of the world?
Yes, it tends to be rigs and carts. We sometimes get lucky and have some snow in Scotland, and we can occasionally get some snow down here in England as well, but it would normally only last for a day or so, if that. So our winters are normally mild, probably sort of averaging in the 30s and 40s, and often wet. And while I've been in Alaska this past winter, it's been very, very wet here at home in the UK, so it's actually been quite miserable. I've been lucky I've been away.
Right. Alex, first question.
So, Kim, I know that you've been involved with dogs and have been doing some dog racing for a long time, but when did you first become aware of the Iditarod, and what made you decide that it would be a goal for you to someday race Iditarod?
I certainly became aware of it when I bought my first Alaska Malamute, and so in the late 80s, early 90s, and basically belonged to the UK club here and then got introduced to it. Up until that point, I never knew about husky racing in the UK at all. So it was a very small scene here at the time. And we, everybody used to sort of, it just, Iditarod in Alaska was kind of sort of the ultimate that we all used to dream of. So we'd often, you know, people would sell books at events and things like that. And that's what where I first learned about it. And then in 2002, I was lucky enough to come and visit Alaska and come and follow the race. I followed the race in a bush plane and followed the entire race, and that's where my interest obviously really started.
Kim, what is the public's understanding, the public at large in the UK? Is it something that, you know, here in Alaska it's on the news every night when it happens, you know, it's on the newspapers and whatnot, but it's not like that in the lower 48. So what is it a world away concerning the coverage during the race? Is it something, if you mentioned the Iditarod just to somebody in public, would they know what you were talking about?
Probably not. I mean, obviously social media has helped and the internet. And, of course, now with the trackers and everything, I mean, the Iditarod website is great now. And I think that's helped to raise some awareness a lot. But no, in general, the general public wouldn't know. And actually, the general public here in the UK wouldn't even know that Husky racing existed in the UK and wouldn't really be aware of it in Alaska. So I think clearly, apart from the group that are mainly running Alaska Malamutes, actually predominantly running Siberian Huskies here in the UK, and then some with Malamutes, and there's some people also running over in Europe with hounds, they would be the ones that really would be aware of it.
Right. Alex?
So, Kim, I know that this first of all, I always forget to do this, but first of all, let me congratulate you on completing Iditarod. It is always an enormous achievement for anyone to do, and I know that this is something that has been a goal of yours and has been percolating for quite a while. Also, I believe this was not your first attempt to run Iditarod. Could you tell us a little bit about what happened the first time that you ran the race?
I certainly can. Well, thank you for the congratulations. So as I said, I followed the trail in 2002 and just had a fantastic time. Fell in love with Alaska, fell in love with the race. I'd been talking about it at home for a long time up until that point, but hadn't realistically perhaps thought about running it, even though I kind of apparently was telling people back in my early 20s I was going to run it. I then came back again in 2006, and I treated myself to be Tim Osmar's Iditarider, and that I just, at the end of the ceremonial start, I just got out the sled. I knew I wanted to come back, and I knew I wanted to stand on the runners myself. So in 2006, I also followed the entire race, and certainly by the time I got to Nome, I was completely hooked, and by then I'd talked to lots of different people and, you know, realised the fact that supposedly normal people can get involved with being able to lease a team. By December 2006, I was back here training. I leased a team from Dean Osmar. I ran Connect 200 in January 2007, came back in the winter of 2007, December, ran the Klondike 300 in January. And then, yeah, I attempted the race in 2008. But unfortunately, two of my dogs got chewed free by my swing dogs. My two lead dogs got chewed free by my two swing dogs while I was travelling between Rainy Pass and Rhone. I came into Rhone with two less dogs. So obviously, I was withdrawn from the race. The dogs, I might add, were found very safe and well, and this winter still remain at the kennels at Dean Osmar, both now retired.
So, Kim, if I could sort of go between the two races there in 2008 and now here in 2016, I believe, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the qualifying procedures had changed during that time. So when you came back a second time, did those old qualifiers still count, or did you have to do a whole other batch?
Well, I hadn't actually realized they changed the time scale. So technically, I think one of my races or something still counted, but I didn't. I chose to re-qualify again. It had been a long time since I'd obviously been on the runners. I hadn't come back to Alaska since 2008. So I came back in December, 2014, and I very much wanted to qualify, and I wanted to try and, you know, do hard races. So I ran the Gingin 200, the Quest 300, and the Northern Lights 300 last winter, and then this winter, which obviously qualified me for the Iditarod, and then this winter I ran the Copper Basin 300 as well. I wanted to be much better prepared than I was before.
Follow up very quickly with that, Alex. Do you think that you were prepared when you hit the starting line there in those first couple of days of the race? Did you feel, you know, I always ask this to the rookies, did you feel like you were ready to go in terms of experience and, you know, qualifications and, you know, ready, you know, felt very confident when you started off from Willow?
I wouldn't say I felt much better prepared before. I don't feel, apart from running the quest, I don't feel I could have done an awful lot more, perhaps with the time scale I'd done. My training had gone well. I was very glad I ran the Quest 300 and the Copper Basin 300 because they're both known to be tough qualifiers. I think ultimately nothing actually prepares you for those 1,000-mile races. I'm not sure if the big races in Scandinavia, I guess the guys that obviously have far more experience out in Norway, I think that helps prepare them more. But I really don't think you can be prepared. And the first few days of the race, I mean, I've even after 200 miles, it seemed to feel like we'd done 500 miles. We're thinking, oh, I was thinking, I've already, you know, this doesn't feel, a 300-mile race felt a hell of a lot easier, I have to say.
Very good. Alex, next question.
In the almost 10 years between your two races, did you notice a lot of changes in terms of the organization or in terms of, you know, how the race is set up and how the drivers are treated, or was it pretty much the same general thing, but you were a little bit older and had more experience under your belt, so you could navigate it a little bit better?
I guess obviously just having that little bit more experience, to say, with doing those tougher races, qualifying races, I think helped me. As from the organizational thing, I've obviously attended two rookie meeting weekends now. They were both excellent, both really informative, really helpful, really useful, and I think everybody in the room felt we learned a lot from them. I wasn't actually involved with the race long enough, actually, on the trail, really, being withdrawn at Roan. It was such a short time, I didn't feel that I could actually say I'd actually experienced Iditarod that much last time to have a comparison.
Right, right. So, Kim, we're talking to Kim Franklin today. She's calling in from England. She finished her first Iditarod just about a month ago, and now is considered an Iditarod veteran, and we definitely want to pass along our congratulations for that, for sure. So if we can, Kim, when we were doing our daily Mushing coverage here on Mushing Radio during the Iditarod, we talked quite a bit about you, in particular those day or so when you lost your team. And I know that you had just mentioned briefly that same thing happened to you in 2008. So my question to you is, did you think, oh boy, here we go again? You know, the same thing happened during my first Iditarod, and it happened again. Can you sort of take us through that emotional turmoil that you were going through during that time, and then maybe tell us a little bit about the story from your own words, because obviously all we heard about it was on Iditarod.com, you know, in the various media outlets. Tell us, you know, how it worked out in your terms.
It was a slightly different scenario because last time I had just lost two dogs. I hadn't lost my entire team, so at least last time I still had the majority of my team and I had a sled. This time I had nothing. Yes, once I'd lost my team, obviously emotionally I did think, I can't believe this has happened to me again, and it was a long time I was without them. I was thinking of the fact I was never obviously going to be able to go back to Alaska again. I couldn't believe I wasn't going to be able to do the race again. I just wanted to go and find, I don't know, some cottage somewhere in Hawaii in an island and hide and never go, never talk to anybody again. But obviously my biggest fear was what had happened to the dogs and had, you know, were they hurt at all? I knew they would be found because I knew that they had the tracker on them. So it was just that fear, and it was actually all night I was without them, and so it was just spending all night worrying about what actually happened to them, and, you know, whether they were fighting or they were injured or hurt and they needed treatment and they couldn't, you know, I couldn't get to them. I think on often these things it's slightly unlucky. I know of other mushers that lost their teams on part on the trail, and they didn't seem to go very far, and they seemed to get them quite easily. Mine decided to run a bit further and hide themselves in the trees. I was lucky that once I'd lost them, a branch had caught my sled bag and ripped it open, and I had lost some stuff. So I tied my team off to a tree to actually just go back just a few yards to retrieve what I'd lost, and then obviously set about trying to patch up and repair my bag to make sure I didn't lose anything else. And I guess where I tied them, because we were in the burn, the tree wasn't ultimately that strong, and the dogs eventually got fed up with waiting for me to try and do it and managed to pull free. But I was with them, and I managed to go with them. And it was as I was trying to sort out, because I had the rope looped round and tied back to my snow hook, as I was trying to basically sort out the mess of kind of, you know, untangling the tree and the rope and everything, I just didn't see another tree coming. I just slid sideways while I was still upright, just slid sideways and got knocked off the back by a tree. And the dogs were so fired up because they'd been hanging around waiting for me to repair this sled bag. They were quite excited, I think, to lose me and went for a nice run. And unfortunately went off the trail. I was incredibly lucky that a couple called Sean and Heidi came up not too long afterwards on a snow machine. So they gave me a ride, which is perfectly acceptable in the rules, because you're allowed any help you can get to obviously find a lost dog or a lost team. And we could see the sled, we could see their trail for quite some time, and then we lost it. And we spent quite a lot of time in the area that we lost their trail. And as it turns out, at one point we were standing literally feet away from them, but couldn't see them, and they were quiet. They'd just gone into the woods, laid down, and were all resting and asleep, and were quiet.
Wow.
And we carried on.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't. Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say we carried on, and by the time we actually found other teams and realized that they hadn't gone on that far, Sean and Heidi didn't have the. We were probably fairly confident that we knew roughly where they were, but Sean and Heidi didn't have the fuel on their snow machine to be able to travel back to where we'd been and then make it further on to Nikolai. They wouldn't have got there.
Alex?
Well, this is just very incredibly compelling, and I can only imagine how scary it must have been to lose the team and then to be close to them and feel like you had almost caught up to them and not quite gotten them. Can you tell us what it was like when you were finally able to be reunited with the team and to, you know, go through and make sure that everything was okay and that all of the dogs were all right and you could continue?
Just obviously overwhelming relief. I just couldn't believe that they were there and they were okay and they were fine. They were lined out. There was nothing. Nobody was tangled. Nobody was hurt. And they were all just quite happy to see me. Immense relief that they were absolutely fine. And then total disbelief as well when the people that helped me from my Iditarod that helped me that, they said, well, go along then, come on, better hit the trail. And so, yeah, relief and say total disbelief that I was actually back with them and back on the race and back going along and following my routine. And then it was like, oh, damn, I've got more of this burn to do, which was quite horrible.
Kim, oh, go ahead, I don't mean to interrupt.
No, it's fine.
Questions in regards to that, and then we'll carry on down the trail there. The first question is, how long in terms of time and miles were the dogs gone, and how far away from you were from the original point from where you lost them, if you know that? And then secondly, we talked just the other day to another rookie musher, Larry Doherty, and he was telling us about the snow machiners that helped you out and I guess fed your team during while they were gone. At least that's the story he knows. They helped you out, and the people that gave you a ride, were they just lay people? Were they part of Iditarod? Were they fans, or who were they?
Sean and Heidi were part of a Norwegian contingency. There were a few Norwegian snow machiners that were mushers that were following the Norwegian team. And
okay.
That's one of the reasons why we became fairly confident, because obviously he was riding the machine, and being a musher, he'd had experience on looking, and being a snow machiner, he'd had experience to looking for teams before, and that's why he could see the trail. Because we were in the berm, obviously large parts of it has no snow, so that's when it became very difficult when we got the dirt, but got onto the dirt, and that's when we lost the trail. So yes, that's who they were, and unfortunately I wasn't able to see them again afterwards, but yeah, that was an amazing help that they gave me. The people then that came back and cared, I think they were volunteers. That was our ditcher of, because Sean and Heidi then went on to Nikolai to tell Iditarod what happened, and the fact that my team were there, because obviously from a tracker point of view, it probably would have looked like it was parked in the woods. And several other mushers then apparently came past. I know Kristen Bacon was one of them that saw my team there and couldn't figure out why she couldn't find a musher there. And because she thought it was buffalo hiding in the woods. She was like, oh, no, there's a whole herd of buffalo right there. And she was trying. It was on, there was a creek crossing, a small river crossing, and we kind of had to wind around it. And I think lots of teams had had difficulty there finding the trail there. And a few teams apparently had tried to go up where my dogs did, both before and after. And obviously afterwards, I guess they were trying to follow my dogs up there. They just missed the trail by literally a few yards. So the people that actually then came back, basically then two people came, and I think they came from Roan, to help me, to obviously help unite with my team. So they dropped one person off with my dogs, and Mary Helwig was actually camped out literally right opposite where my dogs were at that point. She'd been travelling behind me. So he actually went to ask Mary about what do I do. So he went to find out how to use a cooker and how to use my sled and my equipment and what to do. So basically, he fed and made sure my dogs had all their booties off and fed them all and snacked them all and took care of them all and made sure everyone was okay, while they were then getting me to bring me back to my team.
So how far was it? Do you know in terms of miles from where you lost them and to where you eventually found them?
I honestly don't know. I don't carry a GPS tracker with me myself. I don't think Heidi and Sean probably do know exactly how far it was. It was a few miles, not a few yards, but I don't know how far it was. I honestly don't know.
Okay.
And I kind of seem, lost to say, without having the GPS tracker, and I think I was just so worried. I lost probably reasonable concept. But, yes, they did travel. Yeah, I don't know. It wasn't tens of miles. I think it was a few miles. It wasn't a few hundred yards.
Okay, very good. Alex, we have about 6 minutes left. What's the next question?
So moving on up the trail, once you got past the first third of the race, was there a part of the race in the latter two-thirds that was particularly memorable or beautiful or surprising for you?
I think the amount of ice and the lack of snow was surprising, even though we'd been warned. The overwhelming feeling that everybody, the helpers, the locals, the checkers, everybody just wanted to do everything they could, both, mentally and physically, when they could to help us finish. And when I say us, I mean, I know obviously by then I was traveling at the back of the pack and there was a group of rookies, including Larry at some point, traveling together, and we all felt this overwhelming feeling. So that was amazing. In Cowtag, I'd been traveling just ahead of Kristen Bacon for quite some time, and I'd be getting ready to leave a checkpoint as she would be kind of just finishing up her dog coming in. And I kind of got to the stage where I perhaps wasn't enjoying traveling by myself quite so much and lost a little bit of confidence, I think, in myself. And so I spoke to the checkers at Cowtag and said, I'm thinking of waiting here a bit longer and talking to Kristen Bacon and asking if she wanted to travel with me. So Kristen and I had a chat, and I think she was feeling perhaps slightly different, but a little bit along the same lines, and we decided to travel together. So for me, from Caltag to Nome, traveling with Kristen was great, and that just helped massively from a mental point of view. She was also great at kicking me out of a checkpoint if I would have wanted to have another hour's sleep. She was very good and very cheery about it, about saying, come on, no, come on, we're going, next one, come on. So that changed my race. I think still for me, I loved climbing Little McKinley. And then I also loved, I guess, when we were coming down, when we kind of, you come down and drop down onto the coast in the very last run when you're dropping down, sort of coming down into Nome. And it was just like, we actually decided to stay in White Mountain, I think, for an extra hour or something, which we just figured it wasn't going to do us any harm. The dog's going to get a bit more rest, and there was no reason why we had to leave dead on 8 hours. We weren't going to beat anyone, and no one was going to beat us, so what was the point? And it just turned out to be perfect timing because we just dropped down as the sun was coming up, and that was quite magical as well. But certainly I think it was nice when we got into some snow. That was good fun. I was surprised like how much ice there was around Unicle, and then just, I don't know, lots of things it's hard to keep thinking of. But the people and the support was certainly a huge thing that was just gave you a boost all the time. On the other one, I have to say, right, was Lena, a fabulous guy called Andrew, mended. I'm very good at breaking sleds, and he mended my sled for me, and he did such a good job of it. I had another sled that I could have changed to in Unicle, and I decided not to, and I actually took the sled that he fixed all the way to Nome, which was,
nice.
Yeah, again, having people like that, that are just a local guy, just prepared to help. And again, he was helping other mushers at that checkpoint, so it's perfectly legal, it's perfectly within the rules, it was what, you know, the people at the checkpoint suggested to me, and Robert Reddington, he scratched there, and he offered me his sled as well, but actually I decided that obviously it would be better if I could travel with a sled I was more comfortable with, and if he could do a good job of fixing it, that would be the best thing. So yeah, huge amounts of support and help along the way.
So, Cam, I have two final questions before we wrap up, and then I want to make sure that you have some time to thank who you want to thank and let people know how they can get in contact with you if they have questions or would like to follow you on the way. My first question is, can you tell us about, I guess it's more of a statement, can you tell us about what it felt like to finally finish? What was going through your mind, how it was, you know, under the arch and then, you know, at the banquet? Tell us about that possibly. And then I always ask every rookie that finishes if they can give one piece of advice to that person that's thinking about doing this. And we had talked to Larry a couple of days ago, and he had said, you know, just to go out trailer and moving up to Alaska and, you know, chasing their dreams. If you could give a piece of advice to those folks, what do you think?
Again, just so many mixed emotions coming over the line, and mixed emotions during those last few runs as well. Part of the emotions was obviously partly was just so much looking forward to sleeping, so looking forward to not putting another set of booties on. And then partly just, yeah, again, disbelief that actually this time I'd finally done it. And with the problems of losing the team again and truly thinking my race was ended again and probably this was it, I was never going to get an opportunity. Yeah, huge amount of disbelief that I was actually there. Yes, relief as well, which again, it seems a bit sad, but it's just relief. But then overjoyed and just amazement at the dogs. I mean, that's the most incredible thing. I just can't believe what amazing athletes those dogs are and what they'll do for you and how much they'll help you. And then 2 days later, when I was still exhausted and battered and bruised, the fact that once they'd had a good rest and a good sleep, they wanted to go again. So they truly are incredible, and I think every day the dogs just amaze me during training and in the race.
Right.
But
right.
For rookies coming in, I guess I have to say, I have to agree with Larry. I mean, as you know from talking to him, I got to know Larry and his wife Prairie quite well during this experience. We had a really great rookie group. Several things. Yes, Larry's right. You know, go for it. I mean, he brought his whole family up here, up to Alaska to follow his dream. So two, yes, it, definitely people should, if they find a way, you know, if you're not going to regret it. Nobody's going to regret following their dreams and pushing for it and working for it and trying for it. I mean, I think that goes for anything in life. You're only going to, you never you don't normally regret things you've done. You normally regret things you haven't done. On a practical point of view, I started with 14 dogs. It was a hard, fast trail. I'd recommend any rookie starting with 14 dogs. So that was, I never regretted that decision for 1 minute, even though I think I had a lot of advice to start with, and some people thought it was a crazy decision. And then traveling with somebody, that made a huge difference to me, traveling with Kristen. And I think if you can find somebody, and it's often not somebody you necessarily are friends with before or you want to start with, but just that you naturally seem to be traveling at a similar speed, or doing things at a similar time or have a similar aim or goal. And that, for me, made a big difference. Larry decided to push a little bit harder towards the end after he'd obviously lost a lot of time at the beginning. He just put on, he put his turbo, CV turbo charger on, I think, and I could have tried to travel with him. My team was good enough. They probably could have kept up with him, but it was me that needed a bit more rest and wanted. So certainly for me, yeah, for a rookie, yeah, find somebody to travel with, and just, because you're going to have bad times out there. You're going to have times where you wonder what on the earth you're doing out there. And we frequently said, why do people come back and do this again? It's crazy.
Right.
Because it's tough. And then you have amazing times out there. And to share those experiences just seems to make it, both the good and the bad, seems to just be, it's much nicer to share.
Good stuff for sure. Alex, do you have anything in follow-up there?
Yeah, just very, very briefly, Kim. I just wanted to thank you for coming on and sharing your experiences with us. I know there's sort of the, there's the stereotype that English people do not like to talk about feelings and emotions very much. And I recognize that almost all we've done is ask you about your emotional experience for this. So thank you for being willing to share that with us and with all of the listeners. I hope it wasn't too painful. I know that this stereotype about the English is probably 100 years old and doesn't really apply these days, but I am very grateful for you to come on and to be so candid and share your experiences with us.
Well, thank you very much for that. It's probably quite partly true. We're not quite as open, I guess, as the Americans about our feelings, especially when things go wrong. We're a bit stiff upper lip still, I think, at times.
So, Kim, if I could we turn this full circle here? You had thought about this for a long time. You know, you talked about the Iditarod Rider in 2006, running with your Malamutes much earlier than that. Now that you're back home and you are done with the race, what's next? You know, do you think that, you know, I did what I had to do and I'm good with it? Or is there still that burning desire? Is there's got to be more? And again, that feeling question, how are you feeling about that right now, being a month removed from the whole experience?
Well, certainly I think about the Unicleat time and around that area, not because of the area, just because of, I think, the mileage in the race. And I know I said I had a friend that was in Unicleat and I was never, ever getting on the sled again. That probably took a week or so to wear off, but that wore off. But I certainly was never doing a 1,000-mile race again. And that's starting to wear off as well now. It seems to be quite common. I think that's why they do sign up in June when it's all nice and sunny and warm and everyone's like, yeah, we can do this again. I wish I knew. I honestly thought when I got to Nome, I would know those answers. I'd know whether I wanted to run again. I'd know if I never wanted to run again and I was done. And a month on, I'm still not sure. I can't imagine now not doing something again, not coming back and seeing the dogs, not having, you know, even if I come back and ran a 200-mile race or something. There's always been a little bit in the back of my mind about the quest as well, because although I found it tough, I really enjoyed that whole Quest 300 experience last year. So
Nice.
I have been slightly tempted to run the quest, but I'm still at that stage a month on of not actually really knowing what I want to do. I guess ultimately the fact that I'm thinking like that, I'm not completely done, am I?
Right, right. Well, you know, Kim, thank you very much for joining us. Is there anyone you want to thank, any sponsors, anybody that helped you out along the way, anybody you'd like to mention? And then how can folks get in touch with you? I know you're on Facebook, and we made the connection over on Twitter just this week. So, even that little brother on social media still works pretty well with the Twitter, I guess. So I'm glad we made a connection there. Anybody you want to thank?
Well, Maureen Heffernan, who I think you've had connections with, she's done an amazing amount of PR and stuff for me, and put in touch with people. So, yes, her. My main sponsors were drink companies, WKD, Bottle Green, Jungfrau, Franklin's and Sons. So they just helped me get some new equipment and get some stuff, which was fantastic. Dean and Mayum Osmar, who I've worked with all 4 winters that I've spent in Alaska, so the two back, you know, back in 06, 07, 07, 08, and then these last 2 winters. But Dean Osmar, that I leased my team from, that obviously provided all the dogs, that he trained me, he's put up with me. I drive him completely mad at times, and sometimes he's been driving me mad at times, but in general, he's fantastic, and he's incredibly patient with teaching people. Which is really good and nice to have. So, yeah, that's my main thing. And then so many mushers, actually, that are helped along the way. Paul Gebhardt was a neighbour, helped a lot. Michelle Phillips and Ali Zirkle both being very generous in advice as well. All the fellow rookies at the back of the packs, Mary Helwig, Larry, Patrick, Cindy, Billy. I know Cindy and Billy aren't rookies. And then, of course, Kristen Bacon, who... traveling with her was brilliant. So I'd like to thank Kristen. And
very nice.
The dogs, of course.
Go ahead.
as contact, yes, I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I'm at Musha Kim on Twitter. And unfortunately, I don't have a website.
That's okay.
Should be able to be
thank you very much for joining us. I know we went a little bit over. It's a pleasure. I'm glad we were able to make the connection here with a 9-hour time zone separating. It's an early morning here in Alaska, and I assume around dinner time there in England right now. So thank you very much for reaching out to us and telling your story. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for contacting me and asking me to speak to you. it's been good fun.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And I'll have to. I hadn't realized you'd interviewed Larry, so I'm certainly now going to find that on your podcast or on iTunes and listen to Larry, because, as I said, Larry and his wife Prairie have become good friends, and Larry was also very helpful.
Very good. Well, thank you. On behalf of my co-host Alex Stein and our guest Kim Franklin today, and Iditarod veteran finishing the race just about a month ago now, here we are in April of 2016. We'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.